Hello, I'm Paul Johnson. I'm with the Optimistic American, and today we're here to talk about hope. I'm here today with Dr. Emily Bascha. We've been cutting a seven-part series to focus on the whole issue of agency, what happens with agency, how you can lose it, who it is that wants to take it. In this particular show, we're into one of the more important elements of agency, which is finding your sense of meaning. We hope that you'll stay here with the show and enjoy us. Dr. Bascha, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's just talk just for a few moments about kind of the concept of what we've been doing on our shows. And then we'll jump into the trying to find meaning, not happiness, what that means and what that's about. What we know is that our agency is something that each one of us have control over, or having control over ourselves and our actions really is our sense of agency. We've created just a little bit of a different definition to it, which is that there's this information that goes into your head that oftentimes goes through the reptilian portion of the brain first. If you are afraid, or if you're frightened, or if the information that you're getting is negative, then oftentimes that information can't get through to the neocortex, where you rationalize things, where you're able to think optimistically or creatively or hopefully. What we also know is that there is a good and evil inside of each one of us, and that good and evil is something that we have to be aware of and that we have to be accountable for regarding ourselves to truly have a sense of agency. That what ideologies do is it allows us to export that evil, and instead of it being evil or goodness inside of each one of us, we begin to think of it as that group's evil, this group is good.
Oh, we're exporting our self-agency.
Right. And we're giving the agency to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Now, meaning, finding meaning in life is clearly one of the more important aspects and maybe one of the more important benefits that can come from having your sense of agency, from understanding who you are and what it is that you want to do.
Yeah, that's what's going to drive you. It's going to define you. It's going to help you determine actions. Having that meaning is a basis for everything. It's going to be the basis for testing out your assumptions and testing out what it is that you want to do in your life. For me, and for the work that I've been doing in psychology for the last 20 years, I've really come to define self-agency as that opportunity to really fulfill self-determinism through activation of free will. And it comes back to that. And we see time and time again with such amazing heroes throughout our history and across time and space, letting us know that no matter what the dire circumstances are that you survive and that you live in, and you know, we'll talk about Viktor Frankl, very well-known author and Holocaust survivor. Like, can you think of like a more dire circumstance to survive? And yet he still found meaning and purpose and a will to live.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are these powerful examples. And so we're saying for people, you have to find what that is for you. Nelson Mandela is another great example of that. Know what your self-agency is. Nelson Mandela is famous for saying, you can break my arms, you can break my legs, you'll never break my will. And that is so powerful to me.
All right. So as it relates to agency, we have seven programs that we've put together. The first one is the importance of knowing the truth, understanding what the truth is about yourself, about and about the exterior world, knowing that the world is in a lot better shape than you may think, and that the United States is in a much better position than you could possibly imagine. But knowing the truth and knowing what agency is the first step, which was our first show. After that, we started talking about addictive ideologies and the importance of staying unique, staying special. The third one is understanding that you have to put strength over safety, that you have to be willing to grow, and that to grow, you have to be willing to listen to people whose ideas you may not necessarily agree with, or put yourself into positions where you don't feel completely comfortable. Love and connections is an important one that you have to focus on. And then certainly find meaning, which we're doing today, the importance of meaning. Understanding contribution, we, not me, and finally believe. So let's jump into the meaning portion of this, because I do think that finding meaning is maybe one of the most important elements, and again, one of the most important things that we're empowered by through having our sense of agency.
Yeah, and hoping to empower others.
So let's start with the philosophers, because I think the philosophers give us a lot, or the psychologists. Some of them kind of ride the line between the two of them. But existentialism, if you would, why don't you talk a little bit about that and how that plays into the whole concept of meaning?
Yeah, well, an existential crisis is really defined as, you know, one's inability to find meaning and purpose and exercise that in their lives through through their actions, through behaviors, through their thoughts. And it can lead them to severe depression. It leads people to addictions, anxiety, and it keeps them stuck and keeps them paralyzed, keeps them feeling helpless. And so just as you were saying, like, we really want to empower people so that they can find that for themselves. Nobody can do that inner work for yourself. And that's a noble struggle.
So let me give an example of this and tell me if this would fit into that, the idea of an existential crisis. You are an athlete. You're a super athlete. And you have a promising career in front of you where you're going to make a lot of money, where you're going to have stardom, where you're going to have all the things that you could possibly imagine. And you get into a car accident. And in that car accident, you become so crippled that you no longer can, you're no longer going to be that athlete. And so you lose your sense of identity. Would that be an appropriate example of an existential crisis?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, going back to the philosophers, as you were saying, Nietzsche says, the person who has the why can endure anyhow. And Viktor Frankl really builds upon that. And he says, you know, if there's any situation in that you're unable to change that situation, you're forced to change yourself. And going back to your friend, Howard, who said, you know, if you think I'm the one who's crippled, you better look at yourself. If you think your whole identity is wrapped around
your friend who was a quadriplegic,
arms and legs, you're the one who's really handicapped or paralyzed. And it's just so powerful to think about that. And, you know, oftentimes, and you know, in our culture, when we meet, one of our first questions is, so what do you do? As if what you do for a living is your identity. And I would, you know, encourage people to think about how they really answer that question for themselves, and maybe even answer that question differently when you're asked it.
You know, it's amazing when I left being mayor and I went to become a later city council, become a business person. I went through this, I didn't even realize it at first, but I went through this identity issue. Because as mayor, you're trying to service other people completely. And when people come and ask you for help, you give them help unquestionably, and there's no money attached to it. It's just you do it because that's your job. Well, in business, you have to make a little bit of an adjustment, hopefully not too much of one, but the little adjustment is, no, I now actually provide this service, and we get paid to provide that service. It was much more difficult to go through than I actually thought, because I had this identity of who I was stuck in my mind. And the point is that you want to start to try to identify yourself by a different set of standards. I think that's the point that we're making with existentialism, that if you identify yourself by the how as opposed to the why, your identity is subject to being challenged and harmed.
Yeah, and for me as a psychologist, you know, I feel like I'm really here in the service of people and also really trying to understand the human condition and how they got to certain situations.
All right. So let's jump to Viktor Frankl. I know that both of us are big fans of his. I know that he wrote a pretty famous book. He's also been responsible for an important line of psychology. Why don't maybe you give us a little bit of history and how Viktor Frankl kind of ties into this whole concept of meaning.
So he grew up in Vienna in Austria, and he was working in mental hospitals and connected to the universities. He was working as a psychiatrist and also a neurologist. And then at the time, being Jewish, him and his family were sent to various concentration camps and separated. He later found out upon surviving, I think it was a total of four different concentration camps, two of them being Dachau and Auschwitz, very well known for people not surviving, very high death rates. When he came back to his hometown, found that his wife, his mother, his father, and brother all had died in concentration camps. And he was working on a manuscript for Logotherapy, for Man's Search for Meaning.
That was the title of the book, Man's Search for Meaning.
Man's Search for Meaning, mm-hmm. before he went in, and he actually brought his manuscript with him. It was removed, and he committed himself to writing this manuscript upon release. And he says, for him, that was one of his meanings, because that was his unique gift and his unique talent. And he said he was in... He was seeing the conditions, and he had the opportunity to really study man's will in the concentration camps. And in a way, he was looking at it through a hawk's eye view and seeing, like, how is it that, you know, there are two sets of prisoners, one who wants to survive because they want to be connected with their spouse upon liberation of the camp, or being reconnected with their family. Or whatever it was that they were holding on to as the life after being a prisoner. Those people, he found, had better chances of surviving. All conditions the same. There were horrific conditions. People were being executed for no reason. They were malnourished, suffering from starvation and illnesses, no medical treatment. Obviously, it's a Nazi Holocaust concentration camp. But he said, you know, there were two kinds of prisoners. And so he really committed himself to really studying what is it about the will of man that helps them to survive, that keeps them holding on to life. And he was so fascinated with this that even after he was liberated, after the camp was liberated and he was released, he began working with survivors of suicide or people who were suicidal. And he committed his life's work to this.
You know, what I find amazing about him, first, there's so many good stories in that
yes.
book. I mean, there are just mm-hmm. so many great stories that took place in it. But I imagine, you know, he talked about that in Auschwitz, that there was a line of people, and they would send 9 people to the left and 1 person to the right. And he said he was one of the ones that was taken to the right, not knowing that the other 9 would be dead and in ovens within days or maybe weeks, right? They didn't know or understand that. The one was put into work situations. And it had to be kind of a horrific existence. The stories that he tells from that are amazing. But I think one of the stories that really touched me was that he had an individual who came to him. By the way, you can watch actually Viktor Frankl tell some of these stories online. There are people
who
saved incredible, beautiful videos of him 40, 50 years ago telling these stories individually, and they're all very powerful stories. Mm-hmm. In this particular case, he wouldn't answer the question about how he personally was able to find meaning when his children, his parents, and others that he knew and loved were being killed and murdered. But he was willing to tell you, give you a hint on that. And he spoke about a man that came into his office who had been devastated because his wife had died. His mm-hmm. wife had died a few years before. He talked about how terrible it was, how much he loved her, how much he cared about her. And he had lost everything in his life for this. And mm-hmm. and he didn't know how to cope with it. He didn't know how to go on. So Viktor Frankl asked him a question. He said, okay. He said, well, let me ask you this question. He said, did your wife love you? He said, oh, my God, yes, my wife loved me incredibly so. He says, all right. He says, would your wife have been able to survive if you had died instead of her? He said, no, I don't think so. I think that this would have just been too much for her, would have crushed her. She wouldn't have survived. And he said, that's your meaning. Your meaning is to know that she couldn't, and it was your job to carry on for both of you. Now, in this particular case, he said, this man said, he felt like it had cured him. It gave him a sense of purpose. He talked about in concentration camps all the time about how people would, if they lost that sense of purpose, that sense of meaning, they would die. They were so frail. They were on the edge of life. They were on the edge of being able to survive. And the difference between the ones who survived and didn't were the individuals who had some sense of meaning, some sense of purpose.
And even finding meaning in the suffering, mm-hmm. it was, you know, that's a big caveat to his teaching. And one of the stories I remember him telling was one night, it was a cold night, and the guards came out and pulled all the prisoners out and said, okay, you know, you're going to have to do some work in these extreme, like, freezing conditions. People were slipping on the ice, and they were breaking bones, and it was just a horrific experience for them. And there was a moment he was with a friend, and for a moment they looked up at the stars, and he said he thought about his wife. And he said, I pray that she's not able to see me in my suffering. And I'm relieved that she's prevented from seeing how bad and dire this situation is that I'm in. And I pray that she's not experiencing anything remotely close to the pain and torture and torment that I'm in. And he was excited about the thought of seeing her again. And that gave him the power to continue. He said, in that moment, I didn't know if she was alive or dead. And honestly, he said, it wouldn't have mattered. That feeling was real. That feeling was mine. And nobody could take that away. Mm-hmm. And that gave him purpose to mm-hmm. live another day.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's another story that I like, which was the story about that revolves around this concept about how losing hope and meaning can end up the health effect, or the effect that can have on costing you your life, which involved the man with setting the date. You might want to tell that story.
Yes, yeah, that was another powerful story. So one man, a friend of Viktor Frankl, came to him and he said, I had a dream last night. And Viktor Frankl said, what was it? And he said, well, I dreamt that we were going to be liberated March 31st. And he believed this so strongly. He said, that date was really just emboldened in my dream. And sure enough, they were counting down the days, and March 30th came, and there was no signs of the camp being liberated or them being released. And so his health started to dwindle. March 31st came, and sure enough, he died, because he said there was just obviously no signs of them being released that day. And Viktor Frankl said, in a beautiful way, you know, his dream came true. He was released mm-hmm. from suffering that day on
and
March
31st. I think that was Viktor Frankl's way of being able to deal
to make meaning
to make meaning out of the harsh condition. But the reverse of it is, what was happening is that he lost hope.
He lost a set of meaning.
Mm-hmm. It's that important to us, mm-hmm. and it's the most noticeable when life is on that frail edge, like they were there. I mean, there's so many great books that Unbroken is mm-hmm. another good book about three United States servicemen out on an ocean, and the one who ended up dying was the strongest of them, but he had lost his will to live. Overwhelmingly, you having that sense of meaning becomes the single most important thing. I also found it to be interesting, some of the things that he gave people to understand from the prisoner of war camp, stories that he gave them to understand or to help find a sense of solace. One of them I found to be fascinating was there were two or three men that had been picked up and that were taken in for punishment to be tortured. Now, again, these men have already dropped down to 80 or 90 pounds. They're being worked to death. Their families have all been destroyed. You would think there's just nothing left. But these three men that were taken in for torture, who had a high likelihood of their lives dying, the other prisoners went on a fast. And they said they're going to stay on a fast until those men are released. I highly doubt that the Nazis cared. I highly doubt that if they cared, if everybody inside that camp died, other than their ability to get that work done. But Frankl said the important part isn't whether or not the Nazis responded to it. It was the fact that the group had a sense of meaning, that they were going to service and try to help someone else within their ranks. And the person who was being helped knew that there were people overlooking them. He made the comment that we always have people, even when we don't know it, that are watching over us, that are looking over us, that are trying to make certain that we're successful. And he said sometimes that's our parents, or sometimes it's friends that we don't even know are there. He says, but there's always God. There's always someone watching over us in that process, and that can give you hope all by itself.
Yeah, that's powerful. You know, and then Viktor Frankl wrote his book, Man's Search for Meaning, and in that he said there are three ways to find your meaning. It is not through pursuing happiness. Mm-hmm. That is faulty. But you can find fulfillment and derive pleasure and happiness as a byproduct of pursuing meaning and purpose. Do not focus on happiness. Do not focus on financial success. Do not focus on status. Do not focus on anything egocentric. Mm-hmm. It's really about offering your talent, finding what that unique talent is for you, honing in on it. Only you know what it is. If you were to die tomorrow, what would you want to be remembered for? Because he knew no one could write his book for him. He knew he had to survive that concentration camp in order to get that knowledge out there. Mm-hmm. And it worked. I mean, here we are today talking about it, watching old videos of him. It's amazing. He mm-hmm. has immortalized himself through his work. How powerful is that?
So I know that he created the concept of logotherapy. And I'm interested in terms of you as a psychologist. Is that something that works? Is that something that you've seen that others have practiced, or even pieces of it that have been practiced? And can you explain to us what logotherapy might be?
Yes. So before I go into that, I just want to kind of go back to the premise of finding meaning. Mm-hmm. So he said it's really based on three things. You have to invest yourself in the pursuit of purpose. And when you wake up every day, think, what am I going to learn that's new? What kind of new knowledge am I going to gain today? What kind of skills do I want to exercise or build upon today? And he said, you have to invest yourself in that every single day. The second one, he said, is suffer bravely. You know, don't just think poor me and wrap yourself up in self-pity, but really look for what is the purpose and meaning in the suffering. And the second one is, he said, love selflessly. He talked about an example of a mother who had a disabled child, and she had attempted suicide and attempted to kill her child at the same time, and they had both survived. And Viktor Frankl said to her, okay, imagine that you're 80 years old and you're looking back on your life and you don't have a disabled son, and you lived a very happy life. How would you think about yourself, you know, in your elder years? She says, I would think, what is it all for? What is life about? What is it all for? He said, okay, now I want you to think of yourself as 80, looking back at having successfully taken care of your disabled son and elevating his quality of life through that time that you've been nurturing and putting in and investing and loving and being with him. Now think about your life at 80. How do you look back at it? And she said, oh my God, I never really thought about it that way. Yeah, now I see my life's purpose as being very meaningful. I mean, I know I'm kind of giving a very quick example, mm-hmm. and there's a lot to work there when you're asking about working with different client populations. But eventually, that's where she was able to get to, and that's a really good example of logotherapy. It is about being selfless. It's not about being ego-driven. It's about allowing yourself to, you know, use humor, laugh at yourself. Don't take yourself so seriously. So logotherapy, he developed three different techniques. And, you know, a lot of them you can say are behavioral applications to help reduce anxiety, self-consciousness, shyness, depression, addictions, anxiety. And I don't want people to like misapply these different techniques, so I'll just give kind of summaries, and then I would encourage people to really seek consultation with a professional so they can really work through some of these examples. But sometimes, you know, people think of their worst case scenarios in their mind, like, oh my gosh, this would be so humiliating if I did this. And he would say, okay, I want you to do that, but go even further. Like, if you're afraid of public speaking, I want you to actually give a talk and do and say all the things that you're afraid of. So if you're afraid of stuttering or sounding stupid or giving examples that don't make sense, I want you to work hard at doing those things. You know, and people just laugh at themselves and think, okay, well, now I feel like a fool, but okay, I'll do it. And in that, they have a way of almost like seeing, well, it wasn't that bad. I thought it would be much worse, but now they got to experience it. So again, finding your talent, finding your true unique ability, develop that, and he said, invest in that deep reflection to listen to your inner conscience. that experience, because it will guide you. And you have to believe in yourself in order to know that it's there. And that is your inner truth. You can be deceived by all kinds of different things, primal instincts and desires. But these are all very primitive. And you have to look past them. Only you can do that work.
All right. So let's try to give a little bit of a summary to this whole meaning concept before we move on to things that can keep you from getting there. But the word meaning itself comes from the word mean, which really is about how we convey something. Now, the point to that is it is subjective. Each one of us are going to see that differently. What Frankl did that helped, as you mentioned, the three categories, I see them a little bit different, but it's the same concept. The very first thing is, what are you creating? You gain a sense of meaning from what we create. That creation can be your art, your music. It can be what you write. It can be your business. It can be what you do at work. It can be what you're doing with your children to raise them. The second one is love. Love has a sense of meaning. And love is kind of interesting because you can love people, certainly, your children, your grandchildren. You can be loved by your parents, by friends and family. But you can also love a sunset. All right. Yeah. He talked about these prisoners who would gain a secret glimpse of a 1 minute version of the sunset without the guards knowing it. And he says, and it gave them a sense of meaning because they recognized that they were part of something bigger. They loved those sunsets. And then the third thing is struggle. He said you can actually derive the greatest sense of meaning from struggle, that those struggles that we go through can help us define who we are in a greater way oftentimes than just normal life can.
Yeah, and sometimes I'll tell my clients who are really in the struggle and it's hard to see the hope, I'll say, I want you to look back on yourself from the future to the present. And how do you want to see yourself by the time you're done with whatever struggle you're going through? Use that as a measure. Use that to guide your behaviors. Use that to guide your actions. Use that to guide how you're perceiving the situation and what you're telling yourself about it. It's going to be so hard for you to do that right now. I understand that. But at some point, we're going to be meeting again. It's going to be in the future, and we're going to be looking back on this. I'm going to have you do the same thing all over again. I want you to look back on your past self, and I want you to tell yourself now that I know what I've been through, what can I have learned from that for myself now to internalize that? Because now you have some real essential guideposts to help you get through those struggles. Because guess what? Life is going to throw another one.
And he said you could find meaning in every aspect of life. And that, again, happiness can be fleeting. If something happens to your child or to your parent, if you lose someone, you can be very unhappy. But even in that, you can find meaning. And then the second thing that he said, which brings us kind of to the next segment, is that there's a freedom of choice, that we choose how we interpret things. We choose how we see things.
Yes. Yeah, and again, you know, that will guide your behaviors because that's that particular lens that you're adopting and you're seeing everything through. And you're running those narratives and scripts in your mind. And oftentimes you might be missing information that is trying to direct you in a different path.
All right, so let's talk about the freedom of choice.
Wait,
sorry.
Can we, before we go there, sure. I wanted to ask you personally, you have a beautiful mantra and I thought it might be nice to really share because we're talking so theoretical. What is your mantra, if you like sharing it, that gives you meaning and direction and guidance?
Well, I created a mantra for myself many, many years ago because when I left the mayor's office, as I told you that story, I had my identity wrapped up in it. And then I went into business. I had one of my very first business partners who I still love to this day was very focused on making money and being successful. And I found when I got done with it that I wasn't as fulfilled as I thought that I would be. I knew, or at least I thought, that making money was an important part of business. But I began to find as I looked at it that there were other things that were equally as important. Now, I don't want to take away from it. Your business won't be sustainable if you don't make money. And if it's not sustainable, it won't make a difference. So making a profit has an important public purpose to it. But I needed something that gave me guidance so that when I selected the business that I was going to go into or selected the opportunities that I went into, that they would meet at least my definition of where I found meaning. And for me, it was think the unthinkable. It was to change the world, and it was to have a blast.
I love it. Right.
Now, the the last one was important because I also found that there were times there were some people who I actually worked with that I didn't have a blast with, that it wasn't fun. It wasn't enjoyable, regardless of how much money you might make. Enjoying myself became an important component. But
that's good that you value that.
I also wanted to change the world, but I didn't want to change it in an easy way. I wanted to do the complex things, the things that other people would leave alone, which is why we pick healthcare as the area, which is why we pick this podcast to focus on, you know, that the United States is better than you could possibly even imagine. I get what the trend is. The trend is on the other side. I love John F. Kennedy's line. We go there because it's hard.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
The idea that it's hard is a good thing. Now, let's kind of leave that definition of meaning for a moment. Let's go to the whole victim mindset, because I think the victim mindset is tied up in the concept of choice as well. And maybe I'll kind of start it. You know, one of my books that I give to all of our employees, my partner and I give to all of our employees, is a book called The Power of TED. Now, what I want you to picture in a victim triangle is the following. I want you to picture an upside down triangle, and at the top left-hand corner is the persecutor, a person who's persecuting a victim. In the top right-hand corner is a savior, a person who sees their role as saving the victim. And then the victim is at the bottom. Now, the victim is usually defined by being a person who is who has no options. They're stuck. There's nowhere for them to go. They are in this position that they just can't find a way to work their way out of. The persecutor is someone who is oftentimes labeling them or accusing them or making charges against them. But oftentimes, the persecutor also is a victim. They believe that they're a victim, that they believe that they're in this position because of things that other people did to them. And the savior, that's where it really gets tricky. The savior is the person who is giving everything they can to try to save the victim. And somehow or another, it turns on them. Somehow or another, at some point in the process, you continue to try to save them or continue saving them, and they're mad at you, or they don't get better, they don't improve. To me, that one is the one that I would have never thought that's actually a victim, but the truth is, it is a victim.
Yeah, you know, I just want to give some credit to where this model originated, which is the drama triangle. And this comes from transactional analysis. And, you know, I know we're going to talk about it in a moment, but it then evolved into the empowerment dynamic model. And that's really helping to teach people, you know, these are codependent, harmful, damaging, destructive relationships. And we're teaching this model in a way to show people can get locked in and trapped, and in a way that each and every one of them become their own victim because they're stuck in that role. And you want to know what that is before you enter into your relationships. And then, you know, we'll talk about how do you then get out? What is that emerging or empowering or really liberating yourself from that role look like? And how does that evolve? You know, I think for me, as a psychologist, I mean, I see people on all kinds of the spectrums. I see the people who complain about being the victim of a narcissist, you know, being in a relationship with a narcissist and being the victim in that relationship. And then I see the person who's really the narcissist and complaining about, you know, the victim or they don't see them as the victim, but the other person who is really kind of entrapping them and keeping them stuck or, like, you know, trying to take all their resources or other things. And I see the full spectrum of humanity. And for me, the question is, how did you get there? What was drawing you to that person? I'm not going to join you in blaming the other side. That is not my role. And honestly, I will fire clients if they're refusing to make any kind of movement or change. I'll know that I'm not a good fit for them, and I'll tell them that, and I'll encourage them to find someone else. I'll give them resources, and I will very clearly define and explain why. Because I don't want to be that person in that savior role encouraging them to remain trapped in that victim mindset so that I can benefit from them being dependent on me.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was one of the things that I thought was attractive about your style of psychology. You know, we both know that you can go online and you can find these people who play to that victim mindset. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they'll get incredible amount of subscribers by saying, you know, by talking about the terrible relationship that you're in because you're dating someone who's a psychopath or a narcissist or whatever else it is. And if you continue to tell the victim how terrible it is for them and how bad it is for them and why,
feel so compassionate
and be so compassionate about it, they're going to listen to you. It will be, you may get a large following. But the real question ought to be, are you helping people? And to help people, you know, you've said to me in the past that you have to do more work than I do.
Yeah, if I'm working harder than you, I say this to my clients, there's something off balance and we need to rework this shift. I tell my clients, I accept you where you are, but I'm always going to demand more of you. And this is going to be the dynamic. So they know straight, you know, at the beginning, I'm always going to be encouraging and pushing.
All right, so let's break these three personalities down and talk about or think about how a person gets out of any one of those three roles. So let's start with the victim. All right, the victim thinks they're stuck. Well, the victim needs to be able to see other opportunities, other options, that there isn't just one choice.
That they're a creator, that they're a survivor, that they have these abilities to change and exercise self-agency in their life. And it's okay if they fail, but they have to try.
Yeah, we're going to do a whole separate line on the mindset of a creator, because I think that being a creator is dramatically different than someone who sees themselves as just being the victim of circumstances. But here, Frankl clearly said to people, look, you know, first, think through your options. Certainly, you have a lot of other options. If you're in a bad relationship, you can leave the relationship, or you can have a conversation with the person in the relationship, or you can go get therapy with the person in the relationship. But he also, what Frankl, I think, pointed out that was so powerful is that no matter what, you have the ability to frame it. You have the freedom of choice, the freedom of thought to be able to frame this issue the way that you want to frame it. And that gives you a power all by itself.
Yes. Yeah. And so you can see the dynamics. You know, I think one of the things about this model is there's an interplay that's happening, and people don't just get stuck in one. They can rotate and move through other roles. The recommendation I would give to the victim is to start to trust in yourself. If you notice that you're running the same script and the same narrative that is full of self-pity and complaining, I tell people, try and limit it. Like, set a time limit for yourself. Say, okay, I'm going to allow myself this next hour to just wallow in my own self-pity. But once that hour is up, okay, we're moving on, you know, or have one night of it, but then that's it. You're moving on to problem solving, because you really have to challenge yourself to try these new things and new behaviors. Unfortunately, you know, the victims will tend to push people away, or there's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy that they're going to encourage, because of their beliefs about themselves, others to play in that role to prove that they're constantly a victim. And they're participating in it. Even without them knowing it, they're participating in it. And so helping them gain insight is what I try to do in therapy. But it's a step-by-step process. But the biggest thing is really taking those steps and taking those risks and learning to trust themselves and exercising their own self-agency.
And we use Alexander Solzhenitsyn in another one, and he would say, take accountability for what you've done, for your role. So
Yeah.
All right, so let's move to the persecutor, because I think the persecutor
is
interesting.
Yeah, this is an
interesting one. So, and by the way, I call this the triangle on the box. The triangle is what they're all three in, but the box is kind of what the persecutor is in. So the persecutor is making comments or haranguing the victim on a constant basis. But what's
oppressing them, bullying them, right? But what's really
happening with the persecutor really looks something like this, and I'll just be hypothetical. So you have someone you've been married to for 25 or 30 years, and the person is constantly not doing the things that you think that they need to do, and they're angry all the time. So you say, either, well, gosh, she's a bitch, or he's a jerk, you know, he's an asshole, right? Mm-hmm. So what happens when you do that? So when you say, hey, my husband's an asshole, or my wife is a bitch, mm-hmm. you've begun to create a label inside your own mind. And that label becomes a justification for your bad actions. You begin to utilize it. Well, I did that because she's a bitch. I did that because of how she is. I did that because of her personality type. And if you do that enough over time, people begin to recognize, they listen to you, they begin to realize that they don't want to argue with you because they know that you're in a box. So if you're, you know, you can do that externally also. Well, I hate those libtards. I hate those Trumptards. I hate the Republicans. I hate the Democrats. You're beginning to put yourself in a box. And that box, you may not see it, but other people do. And then what happens is they filter their input so they don't upset you.
Well, it's a power dynamic that is happening. And it's out of defensiveness. Mm-hmm. And I would say even insecurity, to try and control and dominate the other person and trying to always one-up them in a power play. Mm-hmm. And so the empowerment model is really saying, I mean, I'm not a crazy fan of the word, of what they were trying to say, but it's really about boundaries, really mm-hmm. about setting good, healthy boundaries for themselves more so, but also for the others, that mm-hmm. they don't get to determine what that other person gets to exercise in their life.
By the way, people who I've written, that I've read, that have written on this, say you can't really get out of that box as the persecutor by communicating more. Because if in your mind you're going, well, he's an asshole or she's a bitch, then when you communicate, you're going to communicate poorly as well. You're not going to do that. You're not going to communicate the way that you need to communicate. The real key is two things. The first one is you have to see them as a person. You have to see them as having flaws and faults just like everyone else, including you. And number two, you have to have some accountability for yourself and what you've done in that process.
Yeah, and it's a process to really break down a person's thought process and what they're thinking and assuming about other people, because usually it's untrue, but it's driven by something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you need to be able to get to what that is. But in order to do that, containment becomes important. Mm-hmm. Containing the anger, containing the control, containing the aggression, and so that people don't unravel and just act on these inhibitions.
Yep. Now, the third one to me is the most interesting. It's the savior in the group, because the savior really believes that they're trying to do something right. They believe that they're trying to help the victim in that situation. And so, you know, if it's their daughter or their son, they go out and they bail them out. They say, okay, well, you're in trouble on this, and you go fix it for them. And then after you fix it for them, you find that they get in trouble again, so you fix it again. And after you do it three or four times, what starts to happen is a couple of things. Number one, oftentimes the persecutor turns on you, right? But number two, oftentimes the victim turns on you.
Yes.
Because the victim begins to say, well, you're making it too difficult for me, or the standard is too high, or you fixed it the last three times, why won't you fix it this time? And all of a sudden, the savior starts to find that they're in the victim role.
Yes, and so what you want to do is move towards being a coach. And, you know, this is how I try and see myself as a psychologist in therapy sessions. And the way that I exercise that is, you know, I help people explore their options. What do they see as their options? What are they not seeing that could be options that are quite viable for them? And what is driving their behaviors? And at the same time, you have to let people fail. It hurts. It's hard. Oh my gosh, it's so hard when I see clients, you know, they're making risky decisions, or even if it's not impulsive decisions, even if it's well thought through, you know, I want to protect them. I care about them. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like the mama bear sometimes mm-hmm. in these situations. And I think, no, I believe in self-agency and free will, you know, over protecting a client. Mm-hmm. And I believe that they're going to get through it because there's something they need to learn. And sometimes we have to let people fail in order to do that.
And that can be one of the hardest things that you could possibly imagine to do when it's somebody you love.
So you're a father, and I'm sure you have like numerous examples and stories of how you've had to experience that and watching your children do things that
Emily, you always turn this on me somehow or another. I always end up in this
spot.
You know, probably the one that I had the greatest success with was the one that I had the greatest failure with. So my oldest son was born premature. He spent, I don't know, almost a year inside the hospital, inside an incubator, and I became very, very protective of him. He had a lot of challenges, gross motor skills, fine motor skills, the things that we had to work on, but I just wouldn't let anybody put him into a position of being second fiddle. I would constantly work with him. When I became mayor, I would have he and his brother take the bus every day to City Hall and do work from the office. So I made certain that they were being taken care of. Well, over time, as I kept bailing him out, the problems continued to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And I recall that one of the things that happened was...
bailing him out, you meaning in adolescence, assuming?
Even beyond that. Mm-hmm. He went on to... he ended up being accepted to a college in Oxford University. He had all types of great skill sets, and when he was there, he got into trouble, right? He got into trouble, wasn't able to continue the program. And then he came back, and he went to go to U of A and decided not to do that. And then literally one day... I get a call by my credit card company, and they say, by the way, his name was the same as mine, and they said, hey, are you in Ohio? I said, no, I'm not in Ohio. And they said, well, okay, you've got some expenditures there. So we canceled the credit card. He called me within an hour. He said, hey, Dad, how you doing? I said, oh, I'm doing great, buddy. How are you doing? He says, I'm doing good. He says, I'm in Ohio. And he said, there's this girl that I'm in love with, so I kind of followed her up here. I said, oh, okay. I'll never forget. I asked him, like, what city was she in? And he goes, I don't know what city. I go, good God, guy, in Ohio, a really big state. But nonetheless, he says, it's just not going to work, and I've decided that I want to come home. Would you send me some money to get home? And I said, well, gosh, Paul, how did you get there? And he said, well, my friends lent me the money. And I said, well, okay, if they lent you some money, why don't you have them lend you some money to come home? And I hung up the phone. I was totally stressed. All right, he's
in
Ohio.
That's a hard decision.
His mom was infuriated with me. Mm-hmm. I mean, just infuriated with me. I prayed every night. Oh my God, I hope he's safe. Oh my God, I hope he makes it here. And finally, about a week later, I get this knock on the door about 2 a.m, and I see outside the window that it's him. I close my eyes. I thank God for a moment that he was there, and I open up the door and I said, "Hey, buddy, how you doing?" He goes, oh, I'm doing really good, Dad. He says, I'm home. Well, I'd had a conversation with my dad before, and one of the advices that my dad gave me was, hey, look, you keep bailing him out. He says, this is my grandson. I love him. He says, but you got to let him live the life that he wants to live, not the life that you want him to live.
That's a hard lesson, I think, for every parent.
It was a really hard lesson for me, right? And and so I said, well, buddy, look, I love you. I said, but we've been living my life. The life that I want you to live, the life you've been living. And that ain't right. Mm-hmm. I said, you have the right to make choices. I says, I'm afraid some of these choices are going
to
put you in jail,
like,
or they're
going to
get you killed.
Prestigious college.
Right.
And that wasn't what he chose for himself.
I said, but it's your choice. Mm-hmm. And here's the deal. I don't mind helping once you tell me what the plan is, once you tell me what it is that you want to do. And if I agree with the plan, being able to give some help. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I gave him a hug, and I closed the door. I left him outside. All right. So he leaves for another 2 days. And again, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, if something goes wrong, I don't know how I'm going to deal with this. He shows back up 2 days later, only this time, instead of showing up at 2 a.m. with a suitcase, he shows up at 2 a.m. without a suitcase. And I open up the door and I said, hey, buddy. He goes, all right, Dad. He says, I thought about what I needed. I says, all right. He goes, I've been sleeping in the park across the street. Some homeless guy came up and said, you don't have a place to stay, do you? And I said, no. And then he said, he took my luggage and walked off. And I go, okay, so what do you want me to do? He goes, protection, Dad. How about just protection? Mm-hmm. So I took him into the backyard. I handed him a blanket. I said, you can sleep out here with the dog. He'll protect you. But until you come up with a plan, this is the best you can get. Now, I have 9 brothers and sisters.
That is
tough
love,
A couple
Paul.
Of them were ready to beat the hell
yeah,
out of me.
You don't blame them.
They were not happy.
I'm taking the side of your wife at this point.
But as it turns out, he finally made a decision. He goes, okay, I want to join the military. And he did. He joined the Coast Guard. He still made mistakes throughout his life, but he began to become responsible for them. He began to fix them. And today he's doing wonderfully. He's working hard. He has a great job. He takes care of my granddaughter in a terrific way. He pays his house payment. He does the things that he needs to do. It's not my life. All right. I would have definitely chosen a very, very different path.
Yeah, but I call that launching.
But I'm proud of him. Mm-hmm. I'm proud that he's found his way. Mm-hmm. And the point that I would give is that as long as we were trying to live my life, I was bound to end up being the savior who was going to be constantly disappointed, upset, and the victim.
Well, he was going to constantly rebel from you and resent you for all the things and living the life that you had set up for him that he didn't want for himself.
It wasn't his plan.
No.
And as you said, the real trick is you have to move from being the savior very early on with your children or your employees or with people that you care about or people that you're helping mentor or giving psychological advice to. You have to see yourself as the coach. The savior, he's the guy up on the cross, right? The coach is the person down on the ground who says, okay, here's the bat, right? And you're going to swing this. The coach doesn't swing the bat for them. They swing the bat. Right? They learn how to hit the ball, and they're going to miss the ball a bunch of times in getting there. And then they have to get up to a plate with everybody watching them and learn how to strike out. Right? All those things are about coaching someone to be able to get through those fears, to make mistakes, to fall down, and then to figure out how to pick yourself back up. That is a very different concept than saving.
Yeah, I think that's a really powerful example, but also just helps to tell how difficult it is, you know, and was for you in that savior role to be able to move to the coach. And oftentimes, you know, we try and create some parameters. I don't want to just, you know, give the advice like, okay, just set everyone free and let them figure it out on their own. There's a yes, but. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, creating some safety parameters, you know, educating, giving people the skills and the tools, teaching them how to fish rather than fishing for them. These are all like really synonymous with all of those analogies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So big lessons maybe that we can kind of that we can take away from this. It seems to me that there are that part of what you have to recognize, again, is that meaning is subjective. And that you have to empower other people, right? You empower other people so that you're not the savior, but instead you're a coach. You have to quit labeling people so that you're not in the box. And then you have to recognize what your options are and to think about how you're accountable for the situation that you've been put into. And once you get through that, you can then start taking deeper steps about what are meaning. And again, what we said with Viktor Frankl is he had three things that you could place your meaning really on. One of them was on what you create. The other is how you love or who or what you love. And the third was recognizing that you can find meaning oftentimes in the most intense way through struggle.
Yes, definitely. That one's really important. You know, I wanted to bring up the Zimbardo prison experiment because I think it's such an interesting example of how good people could be persuaded to do bad things. And it's not like really about good apples or bad apples. And so Zimbardo really looks at that there's dispositional traits. Psychology knows this, that the way that people are growing up through their lived experiences, exposure to violence, that they may maybe have less empathy for other people. But you know, people can reform, people can learn, people can grow, people can change and transform. But there's also situational factors that you can cause good people to do harmful things. And one of the things that he learned from his studies...
Oh, you may want to tell the story. I think that's an important story in itself.
Okay, so the Stanford Prison Experiment. So he had assigned boys, they were students, and he set up a prison setting in the basement of Stanford University. And there were these young men that decided to participate, and all they did was ask them, okay, do you want to be a prison guard or prisoner? So people just randomly selected which one they wanted to be. So they had the actual local police go and arrest people at their homes as part of the experiment, and the participants didn't know this beforehand, and they were put into these underground prison cells. And there was no oversight of how these prison guards could exercise their power. Philip Zimbardo, over time, ended up finding himself acting as though he was the warden of a prison. And there was an abuse of power of the guards. There was starvation, there was physical abuse, there was humiliation, dehumanization. And slowly, and it really didn't take that long, I think it was across a few days, several of the inmates started, the people in the, as the prisoners, started to have emotional and mental breakdowns. And I think they had to suspend the study. It was about a week or a little bit more, maybe 9 days, that they had to suspend the study because it became inhumane.
I love the story about the woman who came downstairs to tell them.
So Zimbardo would say, so this woman who became his future wife, he decided to marry, was the one who basically came to him and slapped him on the face and said, "What are you doing? You're abusing these boys. And this is inhumane, what you're doing, and you're participating in it in your own role as the prison
warden."
They
knew it was a game, but the game began to evolve.
It was an experiment.
Where the boys who were oppressive would say things to them like, "You're not really getting out of here." Mm-hmm. They created an environment where the other boys began to believe, "Oh my gosh, maybe I am really stuck mm-hmm. here." And the other boys who were the prisoners began to act like prisoners would act. They began mm-hmm. to do things that were just kind of off base.
Yeah, so Zimbardo is calling this the Lucifer effect, and he's saying, you know, these aren't inherently bad people. They were all young boys.
So tie this to meaning for me.
So, you know, we can, and there's some other studies about this and replicated different things that are associated, but there's things about conformity and obedience and persuasiveness. We can lose who we are easily. Easily. It didn't take that long for people to find themselves in situations that they were behaving in ways that they would never, ever imagine that they would behave. This could happen to us. It could happen to any of us. You know, oftentimes I'm sitting on one side of the table and doing an evaluation with somebody who's incarcerated, and I think, you know, if I was given the same set of circumstances and situations, would I have behaved any differently? Could I be a different person? I'm just sitting on one side of the table. It could be, you know, very little that differentiates me from this person. And the important thing is everyone must know this. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a time, Zimbardo went on to develop what he called was this path towards heroism. And he says, there will be a moment in time in your life where you are able to act heroically, and will you be that person? Lots of studies have shown us that most people will conform to what the group does, and most of the time people do not intervene in situations to save a person. And he says, you have to look for that situation, and you have to be the nonconformist. Social psychology will tell us there's going to be so many pressures that tells you how you should behave. But if you want to do the right thing in a situation, you're going to have to go against that grain. And you're going to have to really think consciously and prepare yourself. Like, do that work. Know that. You know, I'm confronted with all kinds of situations and scenarios that I think, oh, I'll just keep driving, or I'll just keep walking by, and I'll just let this happen because I shouldn't intervene. It's not my business. And there's all kinds of reasons why I'm telling myself not to. But you must, in those situations, if you really, truly want to be a hero. He told one story, and I'll end on this, that there was in a New York subway station, and there was a Caucasian man who threw himself down on the train tracks for the subway to run over him. He was laying across the train tracks in such a way that the train would run over him. Everyone's watching this. Nobody's doing anything. They're gasping. They're, like, waiting for him to commit suicide. As soon as the train comes. One African-American man was there with his children. He takes his children. He asks a complete stranger, "Please watch my children." He jumps down into the train tracks where this man is laying, rotates his body so he's laying between the rails, throws his body over the top of him and covers their heads, and allows the train to pass over them. He would not have known, but they barely survived by 1 inch. And, you know, you can't make that calculated decision. He shouldn't have left his kids. Like, there are all kinds of reasons, you know, like, he should be there with his kids. He shouldn't have saved him. At the end, there were all these interviews asking him, what made you decide to do this? And his response was, it was the humanly right thing to do. Anybody would have done this. And, you know, it had nothing to do about race or color or anything like that. It was what I felt compelled to do. And they said, nobody did that. You were the only one who saved that man. So, you know, we will have at least one chance to do mm-hmm. the right thing in a situation. Sometimes it's, again, being an anti-conformist.
So that kind of brings me to some lessons to try to wrap this up. The first lesson, that counter-conformist, I think that there's a great lesson in that in this way. Somebody said the other day that the optimistic American was kind of the counterculture in American dialogue today, because you had these two parties, these two news stations, three news stations, and candidates who were all kind of trashing the United States and trashing the American brand and trashing one another in the process. But the point is that we were the counterculture simply because we were looking at what was going right. To be the hero, you definitely have to think outside the existing box, right? And there are boxes that are being created for you. They're generally filled with labels. Generally, being able to find that counterculture or that ability to be outside of it, it's to think rationally. It's not to necessarily buy in. Well, it's certainly to not buy into any ideology, because addictive ideologies can have an incredible negative effect on you individually. But it also keeps you from being able to be your unique self and to be separate. A second thing that I found to be important is, or at least a lesson that I take from this, is the importance of studying other people. I mean, we're talking about Viktor Frankl. We spoke about existentialists, a number of different studies that were done. You know, when I was mayor, I had these two individuals. When I was a council member, I was 24 years old. And there were these two people who were my mentors. They didn't know they were my mentors. I decided they were my mentors by myself. But one was a guy by the name of Terry Goddard, who was the mayor. He was more of a liberal, hard charger, kind of on the outside type of guy. The other one was a pretty rock hard conservative, a guy by the name of Howard Adams, who was the consummate insider. He was exceptional at pulling people together. And what I tried to do, I would watch each one of them on any given issue. I had kind of this front row seat to watching this boxing match between these two greats on our council. And I began to recognize that any one of their traits was powerful enough to be able to win. But if you could combine multiple traits by learning from them, it certainly increased your chances of being able to be successful. Now, their traits were, one of them was knowing yourself. They both knew themselves very well. They knew who they were and they knew what they represented. The second part was knowing the outside world, knowing what the stakeholders on the outside want. Now, in that particular case, the mayor was much better at understanding the outside world, and the conservative really was kind of out of touch with them. The third issue is know the issue, know the details of the issues and how they work. Again, the past mayor was really good at that. Then you go to the next one, which is know the insiders, know the shareholders and the decisions that they're going to make. That can be your employees, that can be your children, that can be your spouse, that can be the people who've invested money in your company, but know how the inside of the operation thinks. And again, there the conservative was much more powerful. Then it was play the long game, not the short game. And again, in this case, Howard oftentimes was better at playing the long game because he recognized that while he could go blow everything up and get your vote on one thing, he'd lose you on the next 20. So he worked the long game and appreciated the fact that you may disagree with him and gave you the ability to do that so that he would have more power long term.
Invested in the relationships.
That long term, investing in the long term is one of the most important lessons that I took from the council, recognizing that sometimes the thing that we want today really harms us from getting the things that we want long term. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Yes. Yeah. And, you know, there was one thing in thinking about when you were talking about mentors, that when I was going through my doctoral program, I was in my undergrad program. And these are really large class sizes, hundreds of students. You know, a lot of people are in psychology because they want to figure out their parents or their family or their boyfriend or their girlfriend. And it really helps to screen a lot of people out because it's just so heavy in research. And I would always go and meet with my professors during their office hours. And I always took advantage of that time. And I would go and pick their brain, ask them what they were researching, try and find out more about the studies or ask about some different projects. And I remember one of my professors said to me, you know, Emily, why are you in psychology? And I don't think he meant anything badly about it, but I felt like he was almost telling me it wasn't well suited for me. And, you know, maybe you should pursue this or something else instead. And I did some tests. I did some counseling tests, and that determined that I am likely not going to succeed as an academic, and I should probably choose something that has a lesser education level required. Mm-hmm. And I was just so surprised by those findings, and because it just really went against what I thought about myself. And I devoted myself to working harder than anyone else in that room.
And that was definitely the last lesson that I learned with them. The one who works harder can make an incredible difference in that process. So the, you know, so again, you know, when you start looking at those lessons, there are just so many things to take from them. If you're going to focus on the long game, recognize that money really, I mean, money is important to be, for any organization to be sustainable. You have to make money for your household, you have to make money inside your company. But people tend to be much more important. The relationships that you build over time, the ability to work with people, your children, your spouses, those end up being incredibly more important. Also understanding your motivation. How are you individually motivated? Now, here's what we know about motivation. There's another study on this, but motivation tends to come from three things. Number one, you have to be challenged, right? It has to be something that you're doing that is challenging to you where you're learning. Now, again, that can be with your family. If you decide, hey, I'm having a problem with my children, or I'm having a problem with my parents or my brother or my brother-in-law, you can begin to study and look at things to figure out, hey, how can I get better at this? How can I make improvements myself to improve this relationship? The second thing that you need is you need pats on the back. Somebody has to acknowledge you for what you're doing. And the third thing you need to do is to have felt growth, to have learned something from it. If you're going to motivate employees, those three things are necessary. And if you think that it's just money, you're going to be highly disappointed. You're going to find that you can overpay them and not get the results that you want. But if you figure out how to motivate them utilizing those three things, you can be incredibly powerful. If you learn how to motivate your children, you can be incredibly powerful. But if you can learn how to motivate yourself, if you can learn how to challenge yourself, to figure out how to make certain that you're at least patting yourself on the back when you're doing the right thing, and then last, that you recognize growth when you were done, you're going to begin to find meaning.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what kept me going. You know, I had that drive, that thirst for the adventure and that ambition. And once I got near to completing one degree, I said, well, what's next? Let me do the next one and the next one and the next one. Mm-hmm. And it kept me going. And honestly and humbly, I never thought I was smarter than any of my peers in the room next to me. And in fact, it always shocked me when people would say, I was able to pass this class without reading the textbook. I thought, and you're proud of yourself for that? I'm not sure that's something I'd be advertising. I always wanted more knowledge. I always wanted to understand more. And that was part of what helped me to be where I am today, to be a licensed psychologist and to have that degree and have completed my doctorate.
Mm-hmm. And then for both of us, I mean, here we sit, all right, we spend time thinking about these issues as for part of this podcast. We spend time learning. For me, I'm 63, and I feel like I'm starting a new phase. I'm able to take some of the things that I've done in my past and be able to utilize them for the future. Now, a lot of these things we'll save for the next podcast, but Emily, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate all that you've done. This is Paul Johnson with The Optimistic American, and we hope that you felt like this discussion gave you hope. Thank you.